Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And we are back today with part two of our Talith Akumai and Harenvoke two-parter. Today, we will be discussing Harenvoke with our special guest, Keith. Well, welcome back, Keith.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
We are here to chat this time about Harenvoke, which is part two. This is the season four premiere. And I know you were discussing a huge change in the DPs and the visual aspect of the series from three to four. And I think a lot of people probably noticed that, but without really knowing why. And so as we go through this episode, please, you know, call to our attention some of the scenes that you notice in terms of the differences.
Yeah, for sure.
But let's get going on our actual, the meat of our mythology here. Harenvoke, German, master race.
Yep. Yeah.
Obviously, this is going to be very appropriate for this episode. This is the, you know, the definition is the German nation as considered by the Nazis to be innately superior to others. Which is a really great title and kind of terrifying. But they're starting this sort of idea of this eugenics plot, weaving this through the mythology pretty early on. I'm assuming that this name, this title, is in reference to the boy and the girl on the farm, these drones that they're cloning. Did you have anything to say about the title, Keith?
Well, it's also a callback, I think, to Nanasazi when. And I know this kind of dialogue just because it was on one of the X-Files albums, I think. They used it as a sound sample, and also Anasazi is just really intense. And it's just like, Mulder, in these files, I found references that were made to Axis Power scientists who were given amnesty after the war, you know? And so then that kind of, I think, is like the first sense that you get of, Axis Powers being like shuttled over. So Nazis and their or former Nazis and their kind of knowledge being shuttled over here to be used for our own purposes. Then Victor Klemper, I think is the character in Paperclip, is one of those Axis Power scientists or was involved with them. Then vanishes after that, of course, because I'm sure he's just erased and killed. And then Nisei in 731 kind of brings the semi-Japanese angle into it as well. What was happening with all that. And so a lot of that then just, kind of comes to, if not fruition, then is referenced again here, specifically through the title. And and that basically now you see the experiments that they're trying to make, which is, these voiceless clones, which I think calls back to the Colony and Endgame and everything, and then ultimately is one thread of the plot, which is this is the alien part. They want to make a slave race of humanity, and so I think this is the human part. This is the human contribution to that. That has nothing to do with the vaccine project, which is the underlying,
humans. It's like a secret thing. Yeah.
This is part of the thing that the aliens are aware of.
Right.
Which is that you have this kind of slave race. The clones are like these clones, these voiceless clones are kind of like they're one of the variations of the slave race who will do the labor, who are immune to the virus, as we discover, that will be carried by the bees, which we discover in this episode for the first time, and which then play out in the X-Files movie rather dramatically.
Yes.
The title is just it's referencing a lot of things from the past. It's bringing in again, American history certainly, and world history, and how that's being riffed on with like extraterrestrial concerns and stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot in the title.
Suggesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Also, worthwhile to mention that the tagline changes in this episode, and it's everything dies.
Yeah, which is something that the bounty hunter says towards the end of the episode, and then Marita Covarrubias twists a little bit,
Jen and I talked about, I think was it the was it Nisei 731 that like the tagline was apology is policy?
Yeah,
and we both was, were like,
yeah, 731.
Yeah, it was 731. We were both kind of like, it was a little weak. They tried really hard to sort of work that into what they were trying to say. I think this is an example of that working really well. I liked, yeah. I loved how they, how that was in the tagline, and then Alien Bounty Hunter says it, and then later we have this glimmer of hope with Marita saying the same thing. And yeah. we don't know. We'll talk about Marita later, but it's just, it's a very nice twist and play on the tagline.
No, indeed. And then, like, you know, a few episodes on in Teleco, you get deceive and vagal obfuscate.
Yeah.
Which is like, what?
That was a mouthful. And then Scully actually has to say it.
Yeah.
Which is,
but this is a cool tagline. It's definitely, it's attention getting at the start of the episode. Like, ooh, what's this? What's going to happen here? So it works, I think, as a tagline.
I remember, this is totally a random non sequitur, but I remember when I met Jillian at Spooky, assuming that she would have been able to write a greeting of some sort, which she didn't anyway. But I was like, oh, I wonder if I could get her to write Inveigle Obfuscate. And then I was like, no, because I can't even fucking spell that. Like, I was just like, I'm going to be like deer in the headlights. There's no way she's going to write that. She's going to look at me like I have 18 heads. But it wasn't good.
You were talking about
she would be like what, no, and I don't know why, but that popped into my head when you said that. As you know, you're trying to think of like cool Scully quotes that she could write, and that ain't it Annie.
one's turning that into a magic.
So we start out, Hera and Voke are cold. This is a really cool creepy cold open. I think it's a really good one. We start out in Canada. We have,
we
have, we
start
the guy
off in Alberta. I just want to say Alberta, where I live.
Yeah.
This is in Alberta, where I live, on the X-Files.
Yay.
Just very excited about it.
And it's called out by name.
We see that it is. Read all the license plate.
Yeah. So I love this image with these creepy blonde boys coming up on this guy and just staring up at him. Like, there's nothing creepier to me than like creepy children. Like when you take something very innocent and then you make it scary, like that always gets me.
Kids are scary.
You even get a very Canadian bee just stung me, eh?
Oh yeah, my god, don't get me started, Keith. It's like, really? We're gonna say a, like, we honestly do not say a at the end of every sentence. I mean, maybe some Canadian does, but not me. But there, it's that stereotype, and I was like, no. I mean, I was so happy it was in Alberta, and then you had to do that. No, sorry, don't like that part.
You know,
I did like the fact it was a TELUS truck, because TELUS is indeed our telecommunications provider. Very exciting.
Look, Jen, it's either that or some sort of, you know, offensive Mark Snow cue if there's any sort of Asian thing happening. I mean, given one or the other, I think the A is relatively harmless.
Yeah,
so.
on the continuum of mildly offensive cultural stereotypes, the fact that all Canadians say A is not that bad. I'll agree with that.
Let's just pick our battles here.
Fair enough.
So we get this, the bee. This is the first appearance of a bee. Season 4, episode 1. And we don't quite see the effect that this has on this guy until later in the episode. But I want to talk about it now because we are talking about the mythology. And the fact that when this bee stings this guy, and he clearly goes into some sort of convulsive seizure and falls off, and then these sort of boils and all the stuff that it ends up doing to him really reminds me a lot of like the stuff we saw in 731, like with the leper colony, and even Jeffrey Spender later in season 9 when he's getting injected with the stuff. And like, it's just, this is the same sort of effect that we're seeing that this alien virus has on humans. And I just find that really fascinating that it's kind of a similar look every time this happens.
It's I think what we can intuit is that it's a strain of the virus.
Yes.
What strain it is, I guess, is open for interpretation. I mean, it's deadly, obviously.
Well, because clearly later the virus has a different effect. By Fight the Future, we have a different... I mean, and they say it in Fight the Future that the virus is mutated. Like, they say that explicitly. Yeah. But yeah, clearly in Fight the Future, the bee sting has a different effect.
So, and again, this, I think, though, fits in with the mythology, because the humans think they have a handle on what's going on, but the aliens are only giving them, you know, them pieces of things. Even the syndicate only knows pieces of things.
Right.
You know, and that's something too, when the bounty hunter says in at the end of the show or the end of the episode, where he's like, he shows you pieces, but he shows you nothing of the whole, because he's inconsequential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, we can get to that and what that all means and stuff, but Yeah, I mean, I did want to pick up one thing because you said I should point out visual stuff. And I will say the first issue, or not an, it's not an issue. The first thing I notice in this episode, whenever I watch it, is how bright that first scene is, which I think works its effect very well, actually. But it feels to me like what happens when they move to LA in season six, first shot is the bright sun. Yeah. I think it's kind of, there's an acknowledgement here that, you know, what was is not what is now in terms of the visual thing. And for this episode, and then Unruh, which was moved out of order, it was the first episode shown out of order, was shot second but aired fourth. And part of Home, the DP was Ron Stannett, who I and I don't know the full reason of why he, you know, didn't ultimately work out. But I think you can sort of see in this episode the DP kind of learning on the job and maybe to some degree finding that he's not entirely suited for it. I think Unruh is a very well shot episode. And interestingly, just a bit of trivia, I mean, people might know that at the beginning of Unruh, there was a scene that was deleted when Mulder and Scully are in the car where Mulder calls to check in on Tina because she's been healed, you know, at the end of this. And but that was taken out because it was moved to the fourth airing.
Right.
That would have been nice.
The deleted scene is just kind of like Mulder had called into the hospital as they're driving. Is like, you know, like, how is my mother? She's recuperating fine, blah, 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 or whatever. And he hangs up. So that kind of is just a little trivia of like, you know, Unruh was, and I relate that to the DP work just because that's why Stannett kind of, it's like Ron Stannett, and then you get Home, and it's like two DPs, which I think is Stannett and John Joffin, who shot up through Never Again, and then suddenly it's, you know, to John Joffin entirely on Teleco, and then back to Ron Stannett for like Unruh. That's because of the out of order airing of things. But
that's interesting because I think I knew that somehow, like it was retained in my, because when you brought up the idea that Mulder had this phone call that he was told about his mother, I remember hearing about that, but I didn't know the reason. So that makes sense. And I'm glad that that exists because it does show that they were attempting to sort of give Mulder a reaction. Because you always wonder, like, you just, and I mean, that's just so X-Files to be like, okay, well, obviously Mulder knows his mom's going to be fine and everything's cool and we're never going to hear about it again. And we're all just prepared for that. But it is interesting to see when they make an active effort to sort of have that little bit of continuity coming into the next episode.
That would have been really nice.
No, it would have been, it was purely, and actually that I have the official guide for season four to thank for this. It reminded me because this was this year that X-Files moved from Friday to Sunday nights.
Right.
And so when it moved to Sunday was the fourth slot, and it would have been Teleco if they went in order. And I think the thinking was, as I'm to understand from this book, they thought Unruh, which I think is right, would be a stronger episode.
Oh, yeah.
To show to people who might only encounter it on Sundays for the first time. So it's kind of, you know, it was kind of the businessy thinking of, you know, what's going to attract.
Right. And I mean, Home is a very, very, would have been a very ballsy choice to put there, even though it's my all time favorite episode. It is a ballsy choice to put there for new viewers. And so of those three options, it's, I think Unruh was the best choice.
So the visual style, I think it really works well in the teaser, the brightness kind of thing. I think they really get some nice landscape shots there. Then, I mean, maybe this is a way we can segue into now the chase and stuff. It's always interesting to me because, you know, after the title sequence, it immediately goes back to the cliffhanger season three. You know, with like, I want you to come see my mother. And then like, you know, the bounty hunter comes, there's no more of that line of he's here to kill me. I mean, they've gotten rid of that 80 yard line or whatever. And so Jeremiah Smith just takes off. And what I notice each time is that it's kind of like when they're outside, it looks John Bartley lighting. And then the minute they step inside with the chase, the image gets really grainy and strange looking and a bit flatter than I think Bartley would normally do. I remember even watching it at the time and being like, this feels different.
Yeah.
Not bad, not necessarily great either, but I remember that chase scene feeling at the time like it just seemed to go on maybe more than a few beats too long.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, I mean, I think it's well shot still. I mean, I get the, I do like the sense of like, I love when the bounty hunter just like jumps and he lands, just like it doesn't affect him at all and stuff like that. And then, I mean, ultimately when they finally get to that hill of whatever the fuck it is, like there's some kind of
wood chips,
it's like
something.
Grain or something.
And then I do remember there's like a light from behind and stuff, and it's just really beautiful and evocative and stuff. But it's kind of like there's an unevenness visually here that I remember noticing that I think affects the pacing of the chase. And you know, I remember feeling a bit deflated within that. But you know, I mean, again, it's sort of like, it's kind of like in the retrospect of knowing where everything goes from here, I'm now more kind of concentrated on the narrative beats in these kind of early season four episodes. And then I remember when we get to like Tunguska, I remember the chase in the airport in that, where they like run down the runway of the plane, you know, thing.
The jetway or whatever.
Jetway. John Joffin shot that. And I remember being like, that, I remember, got me like, always like, oh, they know what they're doing now.
Yeah.
You know, that was like a switch over to, you know, the second DP, and then the third DP in the season after Never Again, which is why this is where it gets confusing, because Leonard Betts then airs before Never Again, which I know is a whole other barrel of worms here. But that's where they switch from Joffin to Joel Ransom, who then shoots all the rest of season four and all of season five, and then also comes back for season 10. So four has like three DPs, and you kind of the juggling of the visual style in a way. And I do feel the loss of Bartley in the early episodes, although it's jumbled because Home is just awesome.
Yeah. Mm. Oh God. Yeah. Look, and I could go on about Home forever. Yeah,
so it's just interesting. Part of the unevenness I feel in Herrenvolk is that I feel like the DP is learning on the job and maybe finding out he's not suited for it.
Yeah. Because it does. Yeah. It's funny. It's interesting that you're saying this sort of behind the scenes information when I watch it just sort of as a viewer. I don't know a lot of this stuff, or I don't know these people's styles or whatever, but I do sense a change. Like, I do sense a difference. I sense that some of the pacing is off. It doesn't quite work. But I don't know why. It's just a sense I get when I watch it. So I think it's interesting that you're bringing this up.
Yeah, I find it really interesting too, because I tend not to be like consciously aware of sort of that kind of interesting visual stuff. I tend to notice things like acting and music and stuff like that. But when I know it, when someone well-informed like Keith will bring me up to speed on it, I'll notice it when I go back and watch it again, which I find so interesting, and it kind of enriches the experience, because I agree that Herrenvolk did feel a little sort of, I don't know, it just wasn't very visually engaging for me, and I didn't really know why, but this is a really interesting sort of insight into why that is. Because I think it's one of those things, like I say, you don't consciously notice it necessarily if you're like me, but it's there. It's still there and it's still important, and unconsciously it still comes across.
Yeah.
And let me just say too, I don't have like full confirmation that of what the specific struggles were behind the scenes. I'm intuiting a lot of this, you know, from just what interviews were given and such. But I mean, I do think you can feel there's something different. And they're trying to, and I mean, now that you think about it, I mean, if they're moving from Friday to Sundays as well, I mean, that's an added, you know, additional production stress. Because we're moving days, like what is going on in Carter's head there, like, and as a producer and everything.
Yeah.
So I always find it, I do find it interesting that like when things get really tense behind the scenes, you can kind of feel it in the show. Which is, you know, my sole real ability to defend Fight Club.
Oh, geez.
Is that it, you know, it seems to come at a point when Carter is just at his last end and he doesn't know if the show's going to come back or what he's going to do. Fight Club just seems to stem out of that. And that's the real only way I can find any interest in that particular.
Because there's always a sort of concurrent behind the scenes story that's going along with what you're watching, and it's not everyone has to be invested in that part of it, but it exists, and it's just as interesting.
It's just reality.
And I think, as Jen said, it can give you a further level of at least insight and maybe appreciation for the struggle, if not necessarily for the final product.
Right.
There's struggles all the way. They're doing their best.
Yeah.
And which then maybe would in my own opinion, in my hope, you know, would be that it would lead people to lead some people to temper the really extreme rhetoric.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I think that should be tempered, but yes. Yeah. All right, let's dig into this, guys. So the little boys, are we to presume that these are all mini versions of Kurt Crawford, whom we meet in Memento Mori, just the way the little girls are mini Samanthas, and they're all the same?
I only took that once we got to Memento Mori.
Right.
I didn't take it from, I certainly at this point didn't think that they were going to have any significance later on.
Right, no, I'm not suggesting that you do. I'm just saying, as looking at the mythology as a whole, when we see Kurt Crawford later in Memento Mori, or all the Kurt Crawfords in that room with the tanks, and the boy is in there, and Mulder goes up to it and says, I know this boy. And so it just makes me think that that's the idea here, is that this boy grew up to be Kurt Crawford's.
Yeah.
Sort of like someone grew up to be Jeremiah Smith.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. But I mean, it does seem, though, at least on this particular farm, this is where they grow the Kurt Crawfords. This is where they grow the Samanthas. And maybe we're to believe that there's another farm out there where they're growing two different people. And these clones are everywhere. And I mean, I love the mystery of it, that we don't really know the answer, but these threads are all here to connect. So I just wanted to bring that up, because they do connect this later in Memento Mori very directly. So I wrote on here, because this is a little bit that I forgot about, and it made me laugh out loud, when Mulder's like buried under a pile of leaves or something, and he just kind of pops out, or the wood chips, or whatever, he just kind of pops out and pokes him. I don't know. I just remember, and it was such a quick moment, and it just made me laugh, because I forgot about him like hiding in underneath the pile of stuff and coming out. Anyway, I just wanted to point that out, because I thought it was very funny. But as we said, that he clearly doesn't do it right, and our alien bounty hunter is still on his tail. But
he goes after Scully first.
Yeah, and I mean, I have things to say about this, because I know Jen and I, we always talk about how Mulder just kind of ditches Scully all the time, and this, I think, is a particularly egregious example of that. To his credit, he calls her later to check in on her and make sure that, like, she's not dead. But, like, he legitimately just leaves her at this mill, and he takes Jeremiah Smith and is like, come help me with my mother. And then they just go. And I, for all Mulder's concerned, like, Scully has been left behind with this alien bounty hunter, right? Like,
well, I'm going to jump in and defend Mulder, which I don't often do, but I am in this case, because I think that Mulder genuinely thought he had killed the bounty hunter, and
that
threat was over, and that Scully would be fine. She's got the car; she can get out of there.
But he's still just he's just ditching her without saying anything.
Well, he is ditching her. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I will jump in here to say my own interpretation, and just watching it. He does initially try to make contact with her. He says, Scully, get the car.
Yes.
And she gets the car. The bounty hunter jumps on it. And I think then Scully honks the horn to warn him.
Yes.
And that's why Mulder says, oh, damn it, I can't do that plan, and has to figure something else out. And I think in the heat of the moment, he thinks, OK, Scully's compromised, so I'm going to, you know, just go, you know, on my own here.
But isn't that abandoning her to certain death? I mean,
he kills the bounty hunter after that.
He kills the bounty hunter.
Yeah.
That happened after the whole car thing?
That happens after the car thing.
Okay.
Because the reason Scully honks the horn is because the bounty hunter jumps on it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Then he goes again after pursuing Mulder and Jeremiah.
Now, I will say, I guess one could say, well, if he thought he killed the bounty hunter and then he hooks up with Jeremiah Smith, why doesn't he say, you know, let's wait for Scully so she can come along with us?
Or, I mean, not even let's wait for Scully. Sorry, my dog has lots of opinions about this episode. Not even let's wait for Scully. Like, how about let's walk over 20 feet and get her and, like, bring her with us? Like, it's just, it seems like a very deliberate and ineffective way to split them up, in my opinion.
I think there's a little bit of, maybe we could argue, a false sense of urgency where Jeremiah is like, we got to go now. Like, he's about to leave. And I think Mulder's just really scared that Jeremiah is about to leave without him.
Yeah.
And so anything that delays Mulder's accompanying of Jeremiah will just risk Jeremiah just leaving without him. And so I think he's just kind of like, I just need to go with Jeremiah. Scully's fine. The bounty hunter's dead. Scully can look after herself. Everything's going to be fine. And he does call her. So there's that.
Yeah. I'm giving him a hard time, but I just always think of in this sequence, it's just like, okay, bye. Like,
it's
peace,
not,
peace
to
out.
To me, it's not the worst. It's not the worst of the Mulder ditches. So it's definitely a ditch, but for me personally, it's not the worst.
Yeah.
It's not the worst.
I think we do have to remember this show is written primarily by straight men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who kind of like,
yes, we do.
Stress thing a little bit too much, perhaps. Yeah. But I mean, and one, I guess, could argue, well, the fact that he thinks Scully has enough autonomy to take care of herself.
Yeah. No. And I mean, I give him credit for that. I just, it's just clearly Scully is in danger when he leaves. And so there's a huge portion of this that I still know as a viewer that Scully is in danger, even though Mulder doesn't know that. I get it, but it's just, I don't know.
I must say, watching this episode again last night, I actually kind of laughed out loud at one point because there's Scully yelling, "Mulder!" while he's exiting on the boat with Jeremiah. Yeah. And all I can think is, this is the show. It's Scully yelling at Mulder while he leaves on some form of transportation, whether it's a boat or a train or a car or whatever. He's always exiting in a novel form of transportation. This time it was a boat.
Yeah, that it is funny. It is a funny image.
I kind of had to laugh.
Yeah, this plays into my theory, too, that Mulder is at heart extremely selfish.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there are very shady aspects to his character. And I mean, I do think, as much as I love the love story, I also, again, will say, I think it's about a guy warping a girl to his point of view.
I mean, I think part of that is very true. I mean, we see it. So
yeah. And I love it. I love it. But, you know, if you think about it in any, you know, really human psychological context, it's supremely fucked up.
Well, I mean, look at what he says in Quagmire about, or what she says to him in Quagmire on the famous conversation on the rock, like, you're gonna end up bringing everyone with you in your quest and everyone's just gonna end up dead. And I mean, Scully sees that. She realizes it and she goes with him anyway, which we love her for. But
I would argue that she does get warped, but there's a difference between him warping her with her being warped by her relationship with him and her love for him. I would say that in any relationship, you're changed in various ways in that relationship. Absolutely. And getting into a relationship with Mulder, you're not necessarily going to get changed in like what would ostensibly objectively be like a great way, but it's just, that's what happens when you're in love with Fox Mulder and you form a relationship with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
you know, and I agree. And, you know, I'm not one who, I do not like putting, you know, like broad moralities onto art. I think it's very, you know, I think it's extremely damaging and simplistic way of reading things.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm bothered by certain things, I actually like it in a way, because it's like, all right, why am I having this reaction?
Yeah, it gives you something to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. And it does not mean I have to end up on the side of, okay, this is great, I get it now, or something. No, it's like, you can grapple with it in perpetuity.
Yeah,
I think
what
we're getting in this conversation is that we have an overarching love for the show, but there are elements that we are always going to just continually grapple with. I can't get on this, or I'm still thinking, like, why this way and such. And so, you know, everything we're talking about here just kind of epitomizes that, because, I mean, basically the fact of this particular scene, he does abandon her, and he does it often, and it's usually in pursuit of something really selfish at his heart, that ultimately she comes around in the series to being like, I'm with you 110% on that, and giving up a part of herself, I think, in the process, interestingly. So
I think this is a great example where, as much as we all love these characters and love their relationship and love the show, that doesn't mean we think they're perfect.
No.
And the fact that they're not perfect, and the fact that they're flawed, makes them more interesting. And the fact that their relationship has flaws makes it more interesting. Oh, so I think that's all good.
Yeah.
I mean, God, the number of times Mulder doesn't tell Scully what's going on with him, it's just like, dude, come on.
Yeah. But that's very him. That's his,
anyway. It's consistent.
It is consistent. That's true. So Jeremiah Smith ends up telling him essentially like to go with him rather than go see Mulder's mother first. Right. Jeremiah is very, 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 he's determined to get Mulder to go see this stuff. Like in his mind, that's more important. And he even dangles Mulder's sister in front of him to get him to go, which is interesting that like this stranger knows that about Mulder and knows that that is something that will get him to follow him.
I don't think Mulder doesn't seem that keen to go with him. Mulder, I think in that conversation, Mulder at that moment is much more interested in getting Jeremiah to come with him.
Yes.
To cure his mother than he is with going with Jeremiah to get the truth, which is interesting in itself. But then he does change his mind when Jeremiah mentions Samantha. That's the thing that convinces him to go.
And that'll do it. I mean, I think that's interesting because that is the thing that will do it.
And it also feeds back into, I said in the previous episode, I don't think this Jeremiah Smith is the one who's in the jail cell, Jeremiah Smith, but the Jeremiah Smith in the jail cell does tell Smoking Man, I think Smoking Man says, you don't know anything about me, and Smith says, I know everything about you.
Yeah.
So I have this intuition, I have this sense that, like, with these clones' development of a moral sense, they also get a perspectival sense on everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that he knows about Mulder's sister, so to speak, is just part of it, because I think it's probably to some degree genetically encoded, and in the development of a moral sense, the encoding becomes bigger, and they basically go galaxy brain.
Yeah. 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 Well, and that plays into the idea too of the chip, which we also are going to come back to frequently. The idea of this alien technology being, you know, created by humans, I guess, but put into humans and used by humans to sort of read these people's minds. Yes. And we see the mind reading, obviously, throughout Gibson Praise, William, all these things. So I feel like that is definitely another consistent element of the mythology that's put in here. And right. Yeah, it makes sense that he would know, because they just know. I thought this was pretty funny. They're driving to find this farm, right?
Yeah.
They run out of gas. And I did write that nice that they have this very carefully crafted, intricately plotted plan for alien domination over the entire human race, yet he can't figure out how much gas they will need.
Well, I always thought they didn't want to stop for gas because it was a stolen car. And so they just had to make do with the gas they had.
Well, no, and also I think they didn't want to give a hint to anyone anywhere where they were going. And only the bounty hunter found out, because when Mulder called Scully, it was nice of him to check in, but maybe read their signals a little bit more and realize,
they're
okay,
not so good at the communication thing. No.
They need to be a little more careful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Boy, they definitely should have had a code worked out by then.
Yeah.
They should definitely. We're four seasons into this. They need a I'm okay, I'm not okay.
Yes, exactly.
The laundry's running. I don't know, something. Yeah. They need some sort of code.
But I did really like the fact that Mulder picked up immediately that Scully was a little off.
Yeah.
Because it's very subtle. We can see it also as viewers if we're looking carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I remember first watching this, I thought, wow, Scully's really pissed off at Mulder for abandoning her, isn't she? Because she's acting weird. But then I realized, no, she's acting weird because of the bounty hunter.
Yeah.
But I do love the fact that Mulder picks up on it immediately. That's how well he knows her at that point.
Yeah. Right? And I mean, it's true. I think they don't give each other enough credit for knowing each other as well as they do. And they don't necessarily take advantage of that as much as they should.
Exactly.
So it is an interesting way. And I love the way that scene is shot. Just bringing out, I think that's actually a really good example of a scene that was shot really well.
No, absolutely. And that's just a simple like dialogue thing. But it's like, it's this great reveal of like, you know, you think Scully's alone in the car. And then as the bounty hunter puts his hand around, the camera moves slightly just to capture that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I guess maybe to bring it back to visual slightly, I would say that there's a utilitarian feel to the visual style of this episode I think probably just throws me for a loop, because I was so used to, at this point, the Bartley kind of like experimentation.
Yeah.
You know, thing about the kind of strangely surreal light sources that would just seem to come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really not much of that in this episode, except strangely enough when they get to the hospital at the end, when the bounty hunter enters and there's a weird like orange light source coming in from the window. Frankly,
maybe it was a tribute.
I frankly wouldn't be surprised if it was just like they referenced, you know, footage from the previous season. It was just like, oh, I'll just do the same thing.
Okay, well, we have Pendril. Yay!
Pendril!
I love Pendril, and I love this scene. I mean, we've got a lot of really good Pendril scenes so far with Scully, but I love this one because he is just like so gung-ho to help. Like, he's up in her little presentation, and he was like, please experiment on me, please check my smallpox scar. Anyway,
I love comes in the second time and he like sees she comes and he's like, oh, Agent Scully, and he adjusts his tie.
Yeah,
and
yeah. So cute.
He's really great. Cute. He's great. I mean, he's one of those characters that like we didn't get a whole lot of, but the parts that we do get of him, the little scenes we do, are just gems. And I love
I forgot there was so much Pendril in this.
Yeah. Well, please, by all means, bring up cute moments between Scully and Pendril, because I love that. But let's talk about this smallpox thing that they're presenting, because I feel like this is another thing that's kind of important that gets definitely brought up repeatedly. But I think this is one of those things that a lot of fans don't quite, including me at times, don't quite understand. The idea that like the smallpox, when they were injected with the smallpox vaccine, it's so ironic that we're talking about this like right now in these times. It's not very, not really timely, but when that vaccine was given to these people, we're to assume that like they have already been sort of set in motion to be colonized. Like they're already being tracked and they're already being monitored since way back in the 50s when this whole thing began. Correct. So what's the deal
with smallpox vaccination goes back to earlier than that, right?
Isn't it like the 40s or the 50s?
Is it? Like, I'm trying to remember exactly when.
I feel like it started around the same time all of this started, which was the Roswell crash. I feel like it all started right around that time.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact thing, but yeah, maybe if you could look that up, that might.
It's been going on for a while, though.
Yeah, but so wait, though. So is the thinking, though, that in order to do the tests, and I'm going to have to bring up Tunguska Terminal while we talk about this because it's important there, too, that they have to access that scar to get some tissue to test the vaccine later? And is that why they have to chop off their arms, because they don't want their scars to be visible so that they can't get that material out of their arm? Like, that's the part where my brain starts to shut down and I'm like, okay, wait, what's going on with the smallpox scar?
Right. Yeah, no, I think as I recall, because it's been a while since I've watched Tunguska Terma, but yeah, the armless people, it is related to the smallpox vaccine, and that is a point where, well, really, I mean, the smallpox thing is a way to track people. So in cutting the arm off, it's like, oh, they can't track us anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because they can in theory take the tissue from your arm, from your thing, and then compare it, I suppose, and track you that way.
I think the idea that I took from it, and I don't really know, was that at the same time that you got the smallpox vaccine, you also got this protein implanted in you, and that everyone had these different proteins, and that they somehow were used to track you, and that the numbers corresponded with this protein that had been inserted with you at the same time as the smallpox vaccine.
Right.
Online, I saw that the smallpox vaccination stuff is like late 40s, early 50s. Yeah. So, you know, kind of in the United States. So basically, it's a way of, well, unfortunately, now I'm thinking, nowadays with vaccine skepticism, I don't like. I kind of like this, but I mean, it's fun in a narrative context where basically it's a way for the government to like track you while also healing you.
Right. I mean, and I think we're just talking about fiction here, and the narrative of the story here is that was their way to begin this plot with the aliens at that time when they first when they first crashed and they first had this whole meeting with the syndicate or whatever. And then they're like, this is the plan. It makes sense that the smallpox vaccine would have been part of that plan because it started right around the same time.
Right. So, it's a good cover.
Cover story,
Then it's a way of cataloging people for the for experimentation or for eradication or whatever you want.
So my question, and this doesn't have anything to do with Heronvoke, this is just because we have you here, Keith, and I just want to ask:
okay,
how does chopping the arm off prevent anything? I mean, if this has already occurred and it's this protein that's been put into your body, how does chopping off your arm keep them from then tracking you if this protein is in your body? I don't understand that.
Okay, well, two ways I'd say that. I think the way Scully describes it here is that it's very specifically localized. The protein is to the arm.
It's right in the
right
vaccination
in the
site.
Basically, the only way you would find it and the only way it would be, it's sort of like, I would think it's like another variation of what the chip in the neck is. Right. Yeah, the chip in the neck is only there. An implant is only there. So it's effectively a kind of microscopic implant in a way that is only in this particular area.
Okay.
if you think it actually is organic and it's gone through the body, however, I would just say in the case of Tunguska Terma, I mean, the people who cut their arm off, they're superstitious people. Right. So it's kind of like, oh, well, this maybe they've convinced themselves that this will work.
Right.
Yeah. It just we don't know for sure like, that it does.
It seems like a rather severe thing to do, extreme thing to do, if you're not entirely sure. That's the reason I'm asking. Like,
well, I think they're entirely sure.
The point is they're entirely sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's and all I'm saying is it's just like it could be the superstition is enough to say yes, this works 100%, even though they have no evidence of it.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it's just and also I mean then we wouldn't get all of the Krycek arm stuff,
which is great, and I love that part of it. It's a really cool, intriguing plot point. I'm just trying to sort of understand the mechanics of it, which I know we don't always really get to understand, but this does make sense. It does.
I think there is a rational explanation, which is basically there's a scientific explanation, Mulder, which is basically the protein is localized.
It's a
localized tag that's in the arm that is administered in the area of the smallpox vaccine.
And I think and that makes sense. Okay,
that makes
sense. I like it. Yeah. Let's go with it. So let's get back to the farm where these clones are, because Jeremiah and Mulder finally make it to this farm. We meet the bees. And Jeremiah has a lot of interesting explanations. He says that like all the shrubs are being grown for their pollen and that the bees are being used to transfer it, which is it makes me think of Fight the Future. Like, OK, so the virus is actually being grown in the corn and the bees are just the method of transportation, essentially. OK.
Yes.
Yeah.
The bees will be released when the date comes for, you know, to infect all of the human race with the virus.
Yeah. Right.
Thinking that it will just be a slave race thing when actually it's going to be, you know, you're impregnated with an alien.
Right. Well, I mean, at that point, you know, things are different at that point. Like it's mutated or whatever, whether it's on purpose or not, we will get to that eventually. I'm sure.
Yeah. But I think that scene with those crops when Jeremiah and Mulder first see them, to me, is very evocative of that similar scene in Fight the Future when they first see those crops again. It's that idea of all these very neat looking crops in the middle of rural nowhere. So I think it's a similar imagery and definitely a similar concept.
And again, the idea of these very normal things being rather terrifying.
Right.
Yeah.
And probably I think it's a budgetary thing. I mean, you know, they can only do so much on a TV budget with this. But when you see the bigger crops later, it's kind of like I think we're meant to think this is more of a recent colony, opposed to the one they come across in Fight the Future, when they can actually have gigantic corn crops and big Jiffy Pop popper things and a helicopter. Truly,
these little shacks.
Just that this one in Fight the Future is a more developed version of what we're seeing here.
Which could make sense as to why we aren't seeing the clones there. Like it's evolved past the need. Like it's now sort of working itself. It's running itself. Yeah. Which again, makes sense.
Can I just ask why are they using child clones as labor on a farm? Wouldn't it make more sense to have adult clones who could handle more sort of physical labor?
My thinking on that, first they say there's the line where it's like where Mulder says, where are the parents? And Jeremiah Smith says they don't need parents. It's one less thing, you know, in the workforce kind of thing. And I think it's just meant to be they will be adults at some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just in their development. That's why it's an early colony, or my interpretation, early colony. It's just like they start them from whenever they start them, probably as young kid versions. And then I'm not thinking they necessarily take like 50 years to grow to 50 years of age. I'm feeling like there's an accelerated growth sort of thing that goes on with clones. And so I'm thinking, you know, it's just like they're kids now. They're not going to be that way or look that way forever. And, you know, Jeremiah Smith is kind of proof of that. And also proof that the scientific thing of it, where they're supposed to just be, you know, voiceless, you know, amoral drones, that actually that there can be evolution beyond that outside of control. You know, and another theme of the series is what can you control versus what you can't control and how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that kind of works its way into the, you know, into what we're seeing here, I think.
I like the idea that, you know, you said in our last discussion that, like, yeah, Jeremiah Smith, can he has clearly evolved past this voiceless drone iteration of himself, as has, you know, Kurt Crawford, as has, like, the Samantha clones in Colony. Like, these are all ones that have sort of developed beyond that initial phase. And maybe the earlier they are, the younger they are, the easier it is to control them.
Yeah, and I would also think, like, the bounty hunter is an example of someone who grows up into, you know, someone who's loyal to the alien cause and everything.
Yeah.
Although I'm always interested to wonder the degree to which, because I think, well, really, probably all of them are possessed with the black oil. You know, I mean, because, you know, the green blood and the black oil thing, that's where my mind starts to spin a little bit.
Yeah,
but I think, like, because the rebels who mutilate themselves are the ones who are not infected by the black oil. And so, you know, but Jeremiah Smith, you know, I would think is, but has developed a moral sense somehow around that. And so that's an interesting wrinkle, because the black oil is basically controlling everything. That's the main alien who controls everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and the green bloods are like another alien race who I think are infected by the black oil and become effectively a slave race to them. And that's what the bounty hunters are. But then there are the bounty hunters who become the rebels, I guess, who have not been infected because they've mutilated themselves, but can, you know, move around and fight against all that. And so it's interesting that there are the ones who prevent themselves from being infected by the black oil, but then there are people like Jeremiah Smith who almost, like, evolved naturally past the manipulation.
Right.
Which I think is really interesting, because it's like one would think he also has the black oil controlling him or as a kind of life force within him, but somehow he's grown past that, which I think is an interesting wrinkle that's never literally explored.
Right.
Yeah. No, this is also making my head spin.
Well, but then, like, it makes me think of, like, the mirror image of that would be Gibson Praise being, like, the human version that has evolved with just naturally occurring alien elements. Like, there's so many different variations, which it's confusing and it's frustrating, but it's realistic. Like, this is the way it would be.
Because you, in science, the thing is, you find variations, and that is the lovely line in this episode where Scully says nothing happens in contradiction to nature, only in contradiction to what we know of it.
Exactly.
So, you know, and that is what I think is being illustrated both, you know, on the surface and in the subtext here and again throughout the series, you know, the thing of it is I don't think anybody knows everything except maybe, you could argue, Jeremiah Smith, but I don't even know if that's the case, because then how much do you take the bounty hunter at face value when he says he shows you pieces, but nothing of the whole because he's inconsequential?
Mm.
Because even though he has a moral sense, doesn't necessarily mean that he knows a lot, but does he know everything?
Yeah. And I mean, the bounty hunters always strike me too as also their own kind of drones. Like, they're loyal to the project, but they're almost like the alien version of, like, the military. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I just mean that in terms of, like, they follow the orders, you know, and so I feel like that sort of just, that's an interesting dynamic too, because clearly Jeremiah Smith is not that. Type of
character. there's a big contrast between the bounty hunter and Jeremiah Smith that we see in these episodes.
Yeah,
indeed.
So we have the bounty hunter shows up after he's showing him Mulder all of this farm stuff, and
Mulder, explain it to me.
Yeah,
and then
you're not getting an explanation.
No, we have to go see more things first.
That was, like, not supposed to be funny, I think, but it was very funny.
It's very funny because that's always what happens.
Yeah, right when he's about to get it.
Right at the point of revelation. It's like, got it.
Nope, we got something else going on.
No, I can't tell you. I must show you. And inevitably, something's going to happen before we can.
Something's going to interrupt this. This whole scene, first of all, Mulder dumping the gas on him was hot. I have to just say that. but this whole scene where they're locked in the apiary is terrifying. And I always forget about it. It's one of these scenes I just don't remember. And then I'm watching it and I'm, like, kind of thinking, like, and I'm not, like, a claustrophobic person, but when I watch this scene, I'm just kind of like, oh my God, this is freaking me out. Please, this scene needs to be over, and it's too long.
It's one of the probably most visually interesting scenes in the episode, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's very evocative. Kind of reminds me of Gender Bender when they're in the hive.
Yeah.
Gender at the beginning. Throughout it, you know, and everything, and just like, you know, the stickiness of it and the claustrophobia of it and everything, and then they push the wall of the comb or whatever over on the bounty hunter, and the bees swarm and everything, and just like, that's really scary in its way. And yeah, I mean, God bless him for being able to make digital bees convincing, because that's the only way. Because in the volume here on the X-Files of season 4, bees don't really read on film.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't imagine they did.
And so you kind of have to, you know, augment them after the fact in some way. And you know, I mean, there are very primitive digital effects in the X-Files, or digital effects was very primitive at the time, but they got it most a lot of the time to very convincingly, or to very very suggestive levels, let's say. I mean,
Right.
my argument is always with special effects that you kind of, it's not about photorealism. You kind of have to notice the effect, but you have to believe the effect within the frame. Not it doesn't mean you make it real. You kind of lean in, you find the right level of fake, I
Right.
think.
And I mean, well, in this, like you said, the sound, I think, accomplishes 90% of that goal. I mean, the sound is what's scary. Like, so you have all
Yeah,
of
that
these
buzzing.
tools at your disposal, and here they didn't necessarily need a lot of visual tools.
Right. And also,
Yeah.
like, when it shoots up, you know, to the sky and everything, you know,
You
I
can,
think
yeah.
it's just really beautiful. You get a sense of how big the apiary is, and then that's a nice rhyme with Fight the Future when you can go even bigger with
Yep.
that.
Yep. Yeah.
So,
And
it's very scary.
also, yeah, like you say, shooting up at the sky, and you can see the bees better. So that's just a nice trick they have at their
Yeah.
disposal to make it more obvious. I love that.
Very scary.
So they, get away, but I did write this because when Mulder is when they're in the car and he's on the phone with Scully, and then the car hits the, they get away. I just wrote that Mulder has to hear his sister scream and get taken again.
Oh, he does, right? It's really horrifying when she's
Right?
screaming, isn't
I
it?
mean, he knows it's not really her, but just like the theme again and the trauma that must instill in him. And then when he has to immediately go back to the hospital and see his mother dying, like, this is another Mulder very bad, horrible, no good day. I said that wrong, but he's
And
having.
I'm just gonna jump in and ask the question, what is up with Mulder taking the clone Samantha with him? I mean, he's got this weird relationship with these clones, I think. Like, from the beginning, he knows there's something up. He knows she's not the right age. He understands that they are clones. And yet, for some reason, at one point, he expects her to recognize him. And then he wants to take one of the clones with him. I'm not quite sure what his thinking is there.
Well, practically evidence. She's evidence. The other side of it is psychological.
Well, you keep what.
He wouldn't take the male clone, you
Right, like
know.
what you said about earlier about not letting go. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to him, but
Any
like he can't.
version of Samantha that he comes across, he wants to keep.
Yeah.
You know, it's pathological. You know,
Yes,
it's
yes.
basically like, dude needs therapy.
He really, really does.
And it is not getting it. And you know, I think a lot of the horrors in the world that we face are because people can't let go of shit. And I think this is an illustration of that, which again makes Mulder profoundly flawed and yet extremely relatable, because I can't let go of certain shit
Yeah. I mean, it
in my
is very human of him, and that's
right.
why we love him. I mean,
But I do think he's also thinking practically of, this clone is physical evidence of something, and if we could analyze her and figure that out, then, you know, something would happen. So that's where I kind of
Yeah.
land.
That
But
makes sense.
also there's the psychological aspect of it. Of course, the clone he's going to take is the one that looks like his sister.
I think that's like it's both, but
Yeah.
that both are at play here, and I think that's interesting. And he
Absolutely.
clearly
And
has an emotional reaction to, I mean, he tells the alien bounty hunter, "Kill me, don't kill them." Like he doesn't even want him to shoot this clone that is not his sister, you
And
know?
do let me say, just tangentially here, I realize now that I curse a lot, I know, a lot of the time, and so I just feel like I make you guys put explicit thing warnings on your
Oh no, we always
Oh
do.
no, we always swear too, so that's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay,
No.
great. But sometimes it's just like, fuck, shit, goddamn,
Go for
God,
it.
you
Do it.
George Warner
Yeah,
shit.
no.
I don't
I
think
yeah, no,
actually we
do it,
tag our
please.
episodes explicit. I
I
probably
think they
should,
get
but
tagged that way.
okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Because anyway. It's not like, it just kind of comes out in the heat of the moment. It's okay.
It's just how adults talk sometimes. It's fun.
And also Mulder is so fucking frustrating.
But yes.
No. Yes. Exactly. He is.
You see,
it just brings it out of us.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway.
So this scene, let's go to if there's nothing else we have to say about the farm, we can kind of pivot over to the farm.
But are we going to go to the scene with Scully and like the FBI people where she kind of proves things
Well, with Pendril. We were talking about that and then I think I deviated.
Yeah. I only bring that up because I had forgotten that Blevins's second in command is one of the guys at the table.
Yes.
Cool.
I noticed that too.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, I forgot that guy. And he's the one, I think, who ultimately shoots Blevins in Redo 2, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he does, yeah. And he's obviously there in the pilot as well. So it was cool to see him again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kind of guy with the glasses who has a weird kind of reedy voice and everything. And it just, I don't even know the actor's name, but I always like seeing him. He just seems like such a second in command who wants to kill his first in command.
And so I love
the scene with, you know, Scully proving with like Adrian Pendril's help everything, but then I'm just like focused on like who's sitting around the table. Yeah. And actually a lot of those guys I think are previous FBI agent people who have shown up before in different capacities. So.
Right. Are they? Right. They're definitely familiar to me. Yeah.
It's nice to see these people continually pop up like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't notice Blevins. So I'm glad you guys pointed that out.
Well, it wasn't Blevins, but his second in command.
Or the one who ends up shooting him.
I don't think he has a name, does he? No, not that I'm aware of.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm gonna take a quick look and see, but keep talking while I do.
Okay. I'm gonna sort of just take off tangentially off of that, talking about going back to the pilot. I love it when, just as right after that scene when Skinner is talking to Scully about, like, what are you doing? You're being all Mulder-y in there. And I love the fact that Scully references her original assignment to the X-Files.
Yeah.
That this is why I was assigned to X-Files in the first place, right? To put Agent Mulder's work to the test of science. I love it whenever Scully throws that in their face because it's like, I'm just doing what you wanted me to do.
Yeah.
It's not my fault that I was smarter than you expected me to be
and
that Mulder was more awesome than you realized he was.
Yep.
And I love it whenever she can do that. And to me, that's the most interesting arc perhaps in all of the X-Files is the reason that Scully was assigned to the X-Files and what she became to Mulder and to the X-Files and how different that was from what they wanted.
Yeah.
And I just think that says so much about her character and their relationship, the way it went so wrong for the powers that be. So I loved that moment.
Yeah. So the actor's name, and he's referred to as senior agent or second senior agent. His name is Ken Kamru Taylor.
Okay.
So he doesn't have a name on the show.
No, he's sort of like Don S. Davis, who shows up in this one as the second elder, who I think has the name the Fat Man, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or I just call him the elder or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, he's one of those. He's another one of those nameless characters who nevertheless seems vitally important.
And we continue to see them. And I do like that they keep getting these same actors back just to give it that thread of continuity. It's
remind us.
Yeah, but prior to this, he was in the pilot, as we say. He was also in Anasazi, and then he's in Herrenvolk, and he's in Nothing Again Until the Redo.
Right. Nice.
Has the big thing where he shoots the guy. So.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's his big moment.
It is his big moment.
But it was nice to see him again and to be reminded of his existence.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And another Canadian actor, if I'm not mistaken, who has just is in the kind of sphere of that particular.
Yeah, just makes sense.
Guys. Yeah, that's always around.
He's been in Happy Gilmore, Reindeer Games, and This Boy's Life, among 136 other credits. So,
he has a lot of work.
He is busy.
Yeah.
He gets a lot of work.
And he seems to still be alive, so hello, Ken Kamru Taylor, if you're listening. We like you.
Yeah, we like your work on the X-Files.
Yeah. So this hospital scene we already talked about briefly, but I think it's just another really good example of Mulder and Scully's connection and how she is going to be there for him. And it's just such a really lovely scene. She has that great line about that's where the hope is that you brought up earlier, Keith, which is one of my all-time favorite lines, by the way, in the series.
A lot of people have mentioned that, and it is one of the greatest lines that Carter's ever written, certainly, I think.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Greatest exchange. Say it several lines.
But it's just a really nice run of dialogue here. And we get a really, really great hug that I think is quite underrated and overlooked, but it's a lovely one. A lovely one.
That whole scene is awesome. It's very, that's like, that's the MSR pinnacle, MSR pinnacle of the two-parter is Mulder walking in at the end there and Scully just like getting at him.
Telling him not to give up, like, you know, it's I feel like, again, it's like another example of when the sort of rational part of Scully leaves when it comes to these personal moments. And she is just, no, don't give up. Even if this is hopeless, we're not going to give up hope.
And that reminds me of One Breath, where she said, where Scully says, as long as she's laying here, you know, there's still hope, which makes me think she's referring back to herself in One Breath.
Yep.
Like, I was in the same position and you didn't give up on me. So I feel like that's. She's then, kind of bringing that to him at that moment.
That's a nice.
And then doesn't Mulder say something similar in season 10 when Mulder is done?
In Home Again, Scully brings it up, saying something like, you know, can you like will someone back to life or something like that?
Yeah.
And Mulder's like, yeah, I did it. I invented that half in jest, full in earnest.
Yeah.
And this is again another moment like that.
What a lovely, lovely callback. I love that.
Yeah. And I love this fact that Scully like is on board with that as a concept too. And she's reminding Mulder of it and in this scene.
You're a dark wizard, Mulder. That's a great line.
I was thinking, because we haven't mentioned him yet. We haven't talked about Skinner at all.
Oh,
Because he is in this episode and, you know, but
Skinner
I don't know.
Is great in this episode.
I mean, briefly, but
I love the scene between him and Scully where, you know, Skinner, just after Scully's controversial presentation or another scene maybe, where Skinner's like, you know, have you found something? And Scully's like, no. And she's clearly lying. And Skinner clearly knows she's lying. Yeah. But there's like this tacit, unspoken agreement between the two of them. I'm lying. You know I'm lying. But can we just gloss over that? And they do.
I like their dynamic.
I love that. Skinner's Skinner's really solidly on their side, I think, throughout this two-parter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now we should get to the big things that happen at the end.
Yeah. Right?
Well, just prior to the dialogue scene in the hospital and then kind of along with it.
Right. I mean, I was going to kind of talk about this as one giant thing. So we have X, our favorite informant, going to Mulder's apartment. I'm guessing to tell him about his mother. I'm not sure exactly why he's there, but...
As the elder of the syndicate says, we can plant some information to determine where this is flowing. And whatever that information is, I'm not entirely clear myself on what the information is. I just figure it's something that, you know, is supposed to be revelatory towards Mulder, but is a lie to flush out X.
Exactly.
Well, initially, I think initially the information is that Mrs. Mulder's in danger.
Grave danger.
And he conveys that to Scully. Yeah. And so that's how they find out, I think, that he's the leak. I'm not sure why he's there at the very end. I always assumed he just thought he was being called again. And that, don't you need me for something?
And it was like a trick. Obviously, it was a trap.
Yeah. That's what I understood.
Yeah, I think it was maybe another way. It was another part of the flushing out process.
Right.
Could well have been.
This death, though, I think is one of my favorites in the series.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, it's gruesome. It's very effective. It's artistically shot. I love the shot. And I mean, it's just such a good death.
Yeah. And Stephen Williams at the X-Files Expo reenacted it when he came out. Like, because he was there. I was there both days and he was there both days. And so he would come out. He would really rile the audience up. He's really great stage presence. And then just out of nowhere, he would do the ooh, and fall. People would be like, oh my God, for a second, thinking he had actually like had a heart attack or something.
Right.
And then he started dragging himself along, and that's when people kind of got it.
Oh my God.
And then he like got to a point and he just started going, G A M N.
Oh my God, I love it.
That was
funny. He just loved dying that way.
That death is like really dragged out, like no pun intended, but it goes on and on, but that's part of what makes it awesome.
Yeah.
I do love the idea too that we have this little cryptic message that he writes in his own blood in a truly dramatic fashion.
I remember watching that with people when they had the SRSG, and these are people who had seen the X-Files before. And they were like, oh, God, we're not going to find out what this means for 20 episodes or something.
Right,
and then
immediately.
MSG. And
I love that.
Oh my God, we found out.
Yeah. And I love that because
immediately.
Yeah, they don't make you wait at all. And
I love that.
It's interesting too, because initially I was slightly confused because it's like 1 month later and I'm like, why did he wait a month? And then I'm like, oh no, he's been looking. He's been going to every single one until he came across Marita. Yeah. Which is great.
The Uniblonder, I believe.
The Uniblonder. Love it. Yeah. But I do love that, like, this is our introduction to Marita Covarrubias, who we will see quite frequently in the coming years, at least frequently as far as mythology.
As will Alex Krajicek.
Yes, yes. And I think she's a great character. We don't have to talk about her too much yet because she doesn't really have a whole lot to do, and we don't quite know whether or not to even trust her at this point. But because she has that really cool turning around of the alien bounty hunter's earlier phrase, we kind of as viewers are like, okay, this will be our new informant.
Yeah, yes. Not everything dies. And I just had to throw out, for some reason, I found it hilarious at the time and have ever since, the way she says, be husbandry.
Yes.
Beekeeping and be husbandry.
She has,
I don't know what it is, but that makes me laugh every time.
She has the most amazing voice. It's it's very sexy and it's very deliberate and it's just so unique. And I don't know if that's the way she talks or if that's an acting choice. I watched her on The Walking Dead and I don't think she talked like that on that, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, no, as far as I know, Laurie Holden, like, that was a choice.
Yeah, you know, kind of have
this sort of sultry Mata Hari-like sort of thing that she was doing. She used very different kind of role, though potentially similarly turncoat on The Americans, when she becomes Stan Beeman's second wife on that. She's terrific on it in a similarly kind of where do her loyalties lie role.
She's naturally mysterious.
Yeah, I do not love her voice. I'm just going to say that right now. We'll talk about her more, and every time we do, I'll probably say the same thing, which is I thought that was just like kind of a ridiculous voice for her to take on, that she's trying too hard to be sexy. And it's like, no, we didn't need X and Deep Throat to be sexy. Why is it that as soon as we have a female informant, we need to sex her up? So I'm just putting that on the record right now.
That's
and you do
point.
Know that the initial second informant who was a female, and that actually those scenes in Sleepless where X is introduced were originally shot with a woman that then they basically changed it late in the production and cast Stephen Williams instead. And so they reshot the side where the woman was initially, but all of Mulder's dialogue is to the woman informant, which you can find in like deleted scenes and stuff. So this is finally the follow-up on the first female informant and everything.
Yeah,
I would have loved if X was a woman. That would have been, if X had been played like X was played, but had been a female character, that would have been awesome.
That would have been badass. I mean, yeah, we don't have to get too much into Marita right now, but when we come back later with Tunguska Turma, is she?
She is.
Yeah. We'll talk about her again.
I literally just watched
And I'll complain about her voice again.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if she is or not, but I think she is. But.
Yeah, I'm blanking because they're running together in my mind. But anyway, okay. Well, do you guys have anything else you wanted to add? I mean, the only other thing I have on here is this final scene where, Alien Bounty Hunter heals Tina and Smoking Man has this line where he says, you know how important Agent Mulder is to the equation.
Yeah.
Which I think is so interestingly put here, and I'm not sure if they even knew what they're going for with that, or if it was just supposed to like spark.
Yeah, it's another narrative plant, and I mean, it's just sort of like I don't necessarily know that they fully follow up on it as well as they could. Although I guess with everything with the brain stuff, I feel like to what this iteration of the project is, he is very important. And that maybe what's interesting about the series is that when they fuck up the project that's been going on for 50 years, his importance actually diminishes.
Right. But in their eyes, but then his importance to the actual aliens and stuff actually goes up in reality, which is interesting. It's an interesting thing.
It is. So.
Yeah. But it's always interesting to hear like our main characters have like this great importance that we will learn at some point. So it's an intriguing line.
Yeah.
So, and I love the look he gives her, which I think fully suggests that the Smoking Man is in love with Tina Mulder, even though he would probably never admit it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right.
It just plays into that just really interesting and complexity to his character that we could continue to explore.
Such an such an evil man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
See, but so a complex evil, but so evil interesting. Man. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Keith. I mean, this was great. I really loved talking about these episodes with you.
Me too.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. We will be back with you in a couple weeks. In the meantime, please do tweet at us at XFD Podcast on Twitter. We want to hear anything that you have to say about today's episode or anything X-Files related, really. And we will catch up with you on the next episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.